Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 13, 2015, and welcome to episode 109 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. Hi, I'm Michael Mulhern, and I'm your host for 109. With me today, we have over in Sweden, Jack. Hi, Jack, how are you?
I'm doing great, Michael.
Excellent. And over on, there'd be the East Coast, we have Ken. Hi, Ken.
Hello, Michael. Good to hear from you.
And not so far away, and still on the East Coast, is Paul. How are you today, Paul?
I'm doing well. I'm pretty far away from you.
Excellent.
But I'm not so
you
far
are.
Away from Ken.
Yeah.
I can see Paul from here.
Yes, I'm on the East Coast that's very west.
Yes.
Well, I was thinking of a host topic for this episode, and as I went off to the Amiga user group here in Sydney, I got thinking. User groups, are they still important to the retro enthusiast's experience? In this age of the internet, are face-to-face user group meetings as important as they used to be? So, anyone else out there who goes to user group meetings or has gone to user group meetings in the past? So, we'll start with Jack. What do you do for your retro enthusiast experience over in Stockholm?
Well, locally, like with people here, it's actually very, very little. Like the most that I've actually talked to anybody about old computer stuff here is I have a friend actually lives in the village where I live, and he's into this old stuff as well. But apart from that, it's like the occasional random if I, you know, I buy some Atari stuff off of the local equivalent of eBay, and the guy who's selling it lives nearby, I can sometimes, you know, drop by his place to pick it up rather than having him put it in the mail and chat a bit about, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But in general, like, I have not seen any sort of retro computing user group kind of thing in Sweden at all. I know that there, I've seen someplace, not in Stockholm, but a bit southwest of here, I think, there's some kind of Atari group meetup thing that happens maybe once a year, and it's over a weekend and something. And I think they're mostly doing like Atari ST stuff, which I don't care that much about, so I haven't really looked into it. But In Stockholm, which despite being this huge tech mecca, at least as far as Sweden is concerned, people just don't seem to be interested in the old stuff that much. It's just not really a thing that comes up. So for me, like, I remember going to user groups for Atari stuff in the 80s in the US, and I quite liked that. It was sort of a good way to meet a few people who were interested in the same kind of thing you're into. But like in my life today, it just seems to really not be a thing for the vast majority of people around me. So I'm afraid I just sort of stick to what I, you know, what I find talking to you guys and, you know, Twitter and Facebook and this sort of thing. That's pretty much all that I have to go on.
Yeah, I suppose that the internet access has basically removed a lot of the necessity for file sharing and the software software side of things of getting drivers for hardware and everything along that line, documentation. But
right, yeah, there's just so much access to information nowadays that it's not really as critical to sort of get tips from other people.
Yeah, we didn't have that that immediacy to information. We can go and find whatever we like now, so it's can be a bit different. So, Ken, user group experiences, do you have any?
I do, though none of them recent. The most recent one was when I was briefly living in Denver, which is home of the Open Apple podcast, and attended the Denver Apple Pie Users Group, or DAPI for short. This is a group that has been around since the 80s when the Apple II was new and is still alive. Whether it's alive and well depends on your definition of well and how many people actually show up. But Randy Brandt was an original member of the group, and he was still in attendance when I was there, or he made a comeback when I was there. And they seemed to be pretty active. They had socials, they had monthly meetups, presentations, mostly Macintosh, of course, but when I was there, they allowed me to speak about the Apple II, although when some people in the audience realized the Apple II was not, in fact, a Macintosh, they got up and left. So there's that. And my first user group experience was probably with the Apple User Society of Melbourne, not too far from you, Michael. That would be AUSOM, or AUSOM for short. And based on what I read online, I don't know how recent that is, they claim to be the largest Apple users group in the world at this time, with 800 paying members, which is pretty impressive considering how much of that experience you can get on the internet. But in my opinion, whether it's a big group like AUSOM or a small group like DAPI, DAPI, I don't know how to pronounce that, Denver Pi, I guess, I think user groups can be invaluable if you happen to be fortunate enough to live near one, because the camaraderie that you get from interacting with people in person is a large part of why we all go to Kansas Fest every year. And if it wasn't for that, we certainly wouldn't go. And there must be something to it. This was the biggest Kansas Fest this past year that we've had since 1996. And that wouldn't be true if people weren't coming for more than what they can get from watching the videos of Kansas Fest online. So I think having that experience, whether it's once a year at a convention or monthly in your own backyard, can be wonderful and fantastic, and I'm sad that it's also rare.
Yeah, I have to agree that it is fairly rare. It's the Sydney Amiga group that I went to yesterday. That was the first sort of more formal user group that I've come across. I've seen some online presence of some others, but it seems to fade away. And I wouldn't mind getting to the Melbourne one, but Melbourne is actually about 700 kilometres or so away from me, so it's not exactly pop in for a user group meeting on the weekend sort of distance.
No, but it is much closer to you than it is to me or Paul or Jack. So there's that. I think me going from Melbourne to Sydney was like an 11-hour train ride, so I can appreciate that. By the time you get there, it's time to go home. Mm. But if you happen to be in the neighborhood, there are other Apple II users there, so check it out.
Yeah. So Paul, how are you for user group experience?
Well, I actually really didn't participate much in user groups at the back in the 80s when these things were new. And now it does sort of seem like the user groups are going to be mainly for the kind of like the vintage tech people, just because they started with it. But now that there's all this interconnectivity and stuff, it's not as you can sort of get the information you want and the sort of some of the camaraderie you want instantly over the internet without having to travel anywhere or even stop what you're doing. So I know that I was going to mention that there definitely are still current user groups. Kind of going against what I just said, but I know that there's maybe like every other week or maybe it's monthly or something, there's a Mac group. I think there's one at MIT and there's one here at Boston University. And, and I see the notifications and I have never gone. There's a WordPress group. I know that Ken probably goes to that occasionally. I have gone a couple times. So there are people who still find this kind of community useful, even in kind of the modern internet age. I don't know. For vintage stuff, it does sort of seem like the population is not dense enough to really keep it going. So I have actually very little experience with user groups, but if you want to include something like the Facebook group, with like the Apple II enthusiasts group on Facebook being one of the most active that I'm aware of, then I'm in that all the time.
Mm. Yeah, well, the Facebook does seem to have really sort of hit the spot for a retro computing user group experience. So that's one thing. But I wasn't quite sure what to expect when I went off to the user group meeting yesterday. And interestingly, only about a third of the hardware there was actually Amigas. The rest was some people playing with Raspberry Pis and doing things on them that had absolutely nothing to do with Amigas. There was Commodore 64, which I suppose is related, but that was more sort of seeing how the motherboard and everything got fitted into one of those clear cases that was on a Kickstarter project. And, of course, then there was all soldering hints and cleaning boards from batteries that have spewed their guts across the traces. And so it was a good sort of mix of retro computer and modern day techniques. We talked about surface mounting, PCBs. So it was a good mix. And interestingly enough, they wanted to make sure that I was coming back, and at the next meeting, could I bring an Apple II with me? Because they all hadn't used an Apple II in a long time, and you know, they appreciated the difficulty of packing up machines, and they said, and then after you've done the Apple II, you've got all these Z80 machines, Dick Smith VZ200 and VZ300, and again, most of those had never been a machine that they played with back then. So I suppose it's more of an experience for people to sort of get together and hands-on to play with the machines, and then we seem to slip back to our email list groups and other online haunts for the swapping of information and bits and pieces, and the user group seems to be more of a hands-on and a sort of a face-to-face meeting, getting to know people better over a coffee and snacks and old computers, of course at separate tables, and then what you can just chatting on Facebook or Google on Plus and things like that. So yeah, I think user groups are moving away from being very tightly focused. I'm sure there are very tightly focused ones, but seems that at least in the group that I went to, that a little bit more loose in their organization, and a good, I suppose, retro enthusiast meeting place rather than specifically, in this case, an Amiga group. But they did make sure that they had some machines there for me to play with, and although the Amiga 1200 is probably the one that I'm going to start with, is a little bit out of the era that I like, which is the 80s and the late 70s, a 1992 Amiga 1200 would not be out of place in my collection. We'll see where we go with adding some new chipsets into my collection.
So they had Kool-Aid and you partook.
I don't think they had to do too hard a sell on the machines, but I will say comparing the each of the Amigas I played with to the equivalent Macs of the day, I would have taken the Amiga.
Mm-hmm.
But now I've never really been much of a Mac person. I use the MacBook Pro, and I have a Power Mac as my daily machine at home. But that's just something I sort of like fell into. Don't really get enthusiastic about the Macintosh line from Apple.
So how often does this user group meet? I mean, is it sort of like monthly or?
It's a monthly group. They appreciate that. We have lives outside of our retro computers. That might be heresy to some of our listeners, but they find that a monthly meeting works best. And we meet at a community hall at Epping, which is one of the suburbs here in Sydney. And it seems to be fairly centrally located for the people who turned up. I think I had to travel the furthest. It took me just under an hour to drive there, but to spend 4 hours on an afternoon, it was pretty good. So gave me excuse to pack up all of the landscaping toys I'd been playing with earlier, but and to get out and just meet some new folks. So I thought it was great, and cool. I thoroughly recommend to our listeners, if there is a user group that you can get to, drop in. It might not be for your preferred flavor of machine, but chances are they're going to enjoy your company and wouldn't mind the machines that are your speciality. And in all honesty, most of us have multiple species anyway, so you're not going to find people who are just going to be TRS-80 fans or are going to be just Atari fans. That might be their preferred machine, but they're going to be happy to discuss, I think, any machines of that era, even if it's just for comparative experiences.
Cool. Well, it's good. Sure, it's neat that you had a chance to go.
While you were speaking, I looked online and found a Stockholm-based Amiga meetup group, but it looks like it's not really doing the best. I had a bunch of scheduled events where it said one person was coming, so I think that it's more a group that is kind of has a potential meetup group that doesn't really seem to have many actual attendees. But who knows? Worth looking into. I loved the Amiga back in the day, so maybe I'll go find some folks to talk to.
Well, I might contact you offline if I start having any problems with when I get my 1200.
Yeah, do so.
Well, have problems.
Yes, have problems and contact me.
Okay. Well, rolling right along, we've got a little bit of listener feedback here this episode. So, Paul, do you want to run us through some of the feedback?
Sure. Yeah, I went through and tried to catch up a little bit on some of the backlog that we had been glossing over recently. But so this is going back relatively far. But Steve, in respect to the 3Com Audrey that was mentioned in episode 104, said get one. He says they're cool. He says they're not bad as an MP3 player. And so if just as a reminder, this was a web appliance that 3Com made sort of intentionally to kind of like put it in the kitchen or, you know, around the house to check your email, browse the web, you know, do very sort of appliancey things. And so I did get one, and I just, was it yesterday? A couple days ago, just started, you know, I sort of took it out and started trying to play around with it. One of the things that I wanted to say about it was that, so it's not that old. I mean, it was released in 2001, but I still seem to have missed the window to play with it by about 5 years. So the problem with it is that it connects to the world. You know, there's an update server that it wants to try to contact and so forth, and of course that's offline. And it runs a kind of version of like a Unix like. I don't think it's actually Linux, but it's a sort of Linux-y operating system behind the scenes, and you can update. People have hacked it. You can sort of like you can get root. And there used to be a like an update type server. Like you could fake the DNS so that it would contact a server that would give you the patch. You know, to sort of like jailbreak your Audrey. But of course that stopped. Last I heard of that working was 2006. So it's quite frustrating. So I've looked around a little bit on there's a hacking wiki, which itself hasn't really seen much updating since about that time. And I'm still kind of hopeful that I can take that I can find a way to sort of flash the ROM and get it to do something, because it does seem cool. But anyway, so Steve says it's cool. And I tend to agree. We'll put a link into, I don't think we had this link before, but the DigiBarn Computer Museum has a, like a little display of a white Audrey. And, they also came in a couple other colors. I think maybe even here there's a picture of a black one. And I've seen a mint green one as well. Mine's kind of like white / linen, but, anyway. That was less listener feedback and more just me ranting about the Audrey, I guess. Let's see. Okay, so Bob wrote to point out that there is a repair kit for HP calculators of the Woodstock variety, like the HP 25. And he gave a link to this. It's at panamatic.de. And it, basically, it has some replacement parts for, and I don't even know what this stands for, but the PMOS ACT chip, which apparently is a common failure point on these old calculators due to some sort of flaw in the power supply. So a lot of the calculators of this era of the HP 25 type that don't work because of this chip being blown. So on this site, there are replacements for that. There are replacements for the LEDs. There's actually an upgrade ACT chip you can get. It's kind of neat. So if anyone has played around with these calculators and or collects them or has some broken ones, might be kind of neat to see this. Have any of you actually done any of this sort of like calculator stuff?
Not to this level, but I've just gone and bookmarked that link because I've been offered some old HP calculators. I don't know what models, and I said yes, I'd take them off their hands, and if they interest me enough, I might find some shelf space. And of course, you know, my philosophy is that, you know, something that goes into my collection has got to be is preferable that it's working. So if I need to get them going, and just something different from instead of just working on larger devices. But that looks quite interesting. So thank you, Bob.
Yeah, it does seem pretty cool. Another person that has written in to tell us about something is Wayne, who wrote in to tell us about his remake of the classic pinball game Raster Blaster. So Raster Blaster was written by Bill Budge. I think originally it was on the Apple II. And so Raster Blaster Reloaded is a tribute. It's basically, you know, it's smoother, you know, less sort of jaggy looking graphics, but it's... otherwise, it's basically a remake of the Raster Blaster pinball game. It runs on Windows and Mac and Android and Linux, and we'll put a link in there. But it looks pretty cool. I have not tried to play it. But are you guys familiar with it? In its old form?
I seem to remember the name.
Oh, definitely familiar with Raster Blaster. Yeah, I used to spend a lot of time up in the back row at university in the computer lab playing Raster Blaster.
Yeah, I played the original as a kid, and I've played a little bit of Wayne's remake.
Ah, okay. What did you think? If you didn't like it, we'll edit it out.
No, I did like it. As far as I can tell, it's pretty accurate to the original. I didn't boot up the original to do a side-by-side comparison, but this seems pretty authentic. I did ask him if it was an authorized port, and he said no, he was not affiliated with Bill Budge. I meant to follow up and ask if he had access to the source code. I don't remember if the source code for Raster Blaster has been released. Does anybody know?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay. Because I myself have ported games just by looking at the end user experience and thinking about what code would simulate that experience, so without actually seeing the original source code, and that's certainly possible, but with a physics-based game like Raster Blaster, it might be a little bit more complex. And so I'm wondering how he approached it. That's all.
Yeah, apparently, according to Wikipedia, this is this resembles the classic firepower table, which means nothing to me, but might mean something to others. And it was voted in Soft Talk as a magazine as the most popular program of 1981, which is interesting. Cool. So anyway, I will play it. I'm looking forward to trying it out. I definitely did waste a certain amount of time in my youth on that. So thanks, Wayne. Let's see. So there's one quick one. Andrew wrote, just sort of expressing his disbelief that someone would have made a machine like the Sega Terra Drive, and was wondering if anyone essentially could tell him what they were thinking. But I had not heard about this before. But this apparently is it was marketed only in Japan. It's a weird mix of a 286 PC, which by then was already, like, 486s were out at that time, but it was a IBM AT class machine in the same box as a Sega Genesis. And it was, you know, so it had a disk drive and a cartridge slot, and it was essentially two processors that could kind of communicate with some in some way, and I don't know, seems like a very weird thing. But so I don't know, let us know if you have any insight into that. I searched around a little bit on the web, and there's some information on it, and there's some very, you know, weird Japanese ads, but.
Yeah, no, that feedback was the first I ever heard of such a thing.
Mm.
It seems really, really strange, the whole thing. And I'm not surprised it didn't sell well. I assume it didn't sell well anyway.
I think it did. That's the dumb thing. I think it actually did. I think really? It was actually relatively popular in Japan for a brief while, but it never made it out of Japan. So.
Oh, Japan.
Maybe someone found a small warehouse of parts and thought, what could they do with it? And then by the time they could have hit the export market, they'd run out of 286s.
You know, but
who knows?
As I understand it, though, this thing was actually built by IBM. So, I don't know. It's a weird thing. It's a weird thing. Maybe it's just a joke on like Wikipedia. but anyway. And the last bit of feedback I'll mention, this is a long feedback segment, but I had a long backlog. Oscar wrote in, with regards to the mention of the GMC4 4-bit computer in episode 107. That was a somewhat recent replica of the computer that was basically instantiated in that Radio Shack microcomputer trainer that came up a little while back. Maybe that was 107 also. Anyway, so Christopher Haberer, I may have pronounced that correctly, designed an Arduino-based replica that doesn't cost very much to make, and Oscar sent a link to a discussion of a build workshop that was held. It's in German, but you can run it through Google Translate to kind of get a sense of what's being said. I was not able to figure out, so I think they were talking about building this kit, and I was not able to figure out how to get a hold of this kit, but the source, the code for everything is on GitHub, and we'll have a link to that, and quite possibly the kit is out there somewhere. But Oscar also mentioned that he reminded us of the Kim Uno kit that he makes, which is a Arduino-based Kim 1 replica. We mentioned that back in episode 85, in fact, but you can still get it. It's $15 as a kit or $40 built, and then you have to have it shipped to you, but looks pretty cool. It still looks pretty cool. I still don't have one, but maybe I will do that after I build his other kit, which we'll mention again later. So thanks all for writing to us. We will try to keep up a little bit better, but we do appreciate people writing, and yes, that's it.
Oh, it's good to get the feedback from the listeners. Yes, Oscar's got some great stuff out there. So let's move on into our items of interest and news section. So, Jack, do you want to start with what one of our colleagues has been up to lately?
Absolutely. Well, Earl Evans, the esteemed Earl Evans, who's not with us today on our broadcast, he has restarted his old podcast, one of his old podcasts called Chicken Lips Radio. Chicken Lips being a reference to the classic look of the Commodore logo, which kind of resembled a bird in a way. And so my understanding, there was one episode of this put out in 2013 June. And that's the only episode that was put out until now. And so now he has a new co-host named Todd George. They are both talking about Commodore stuff. I know Earl's been doing interesting things, and I'm sure Todd as well. It'll be good to have this podcast up and running again. I've heard Earl mention this. I've actually never listened to episode 1 before, but now that it's up and running again, I'll subscribe and listen to both episode 1 and 2, and hopefully 3 and 4 and etc.
Yeah, it was great to have Chicken Lip Radio back on the air, because I've always been interested in the Commodore. I haven't yet bought one for myself, but I think I'm trending in that direction. So there could be a Commodore 64 in my collection very, very soon. But no, great work to Todd and Earl for getting Chicken Lips Radio back on the air, doubling the number of available episodes. So, Ken, who's this Steve Jobs and why is he in a machine?
I heard he had something to do with Apple. I guess Steve Wozniak wasn't the only Steve responsible for the founding of the company. I don't know. Anyway, there is a new documentary about Steve Jobs, and usually when I tell this to people who do not exist in the retro computing community, they ask me, oh, you mean the Ashton Kutcher one? And I'm like, no. No, not even close. That's not a documentary, and it came out 2 years ago. No, go back to wherever you came from. I'm talking about Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine. This is a documentary, also not to be confused with the Michael Fassbender film coming out next month in October, based on the Walter Isaacson biography with a screenplay by Aaron Sorkin of The West Wing and The Social Network. This is a documentary, which means that the person playing Steve Jobs in this film is Steve Jobs. And wow, he nailed the character, I gotta tell you. So there is plenty of archival footage from various Macworld presentations, from depositions that he gave, from interviews that he gave, lots of footage of Steve Jobs, interspersed with modern or new original interviews with the likes of Chris Ann Brennan, his one-time lover and mother of his daughter Lisa, Dan Kottke, his travel buddy in India and Apple employee number 12, I believe, and let's see, the Regis McKenna, who I believe was the mastermind behind the 1984 commercial, Nolan Bushnell, his one-time boss at Atari, and many, many more. So this is a two-hour documentary that was released on September 5th in theaters and video on demand. You can get it in iTunes. I had the privilege of an advanced copy. I don't know if that creates a conflict of interest or a bias, which I want to be forthcoming about. But I reviewed it for Computer World, and it actually took me a couple of viewings to appreciate this film. I thought it was a bit long at 2 hours, so to have to watch it twice to really appreciate it, maybe I was distracted the first time, or maybe the film just wasn't obvious enough for me. But I at first took it as a mere presentation of the facts, which you should not do, because if you're listening to this podcast, you already know all the facts. If you read the Walter Isaacson book, you know everything that's in this film. It's not going to tell you anything new about Steve Jobs. There's no hidden chapter of his life. In fact, just like the Ashton Kutcher film, it skips a lot of the time he spent away from Apple when he was working with Next and Pixar, which, in my opinion, are formulative periods in his life. They are essential to the man that he became when he returned to Apple in 97. And so many books and pieces about Steve Jobs just seem to gloss over it because they think that Steve Jobs is the story of Apple and vice versa, which is frustrating and untrue. Anyway, but it is an interesting movie that takes a look at the question, if Steve Jobs was so heartless and cruel to so many and so aloof and so antisocial, to put it kindly, actually, then how come we were so upset when he died? And I was upset when he died, and the masses were upset when he died. People who have been with Apple computers since the Apple II in the 70s, or people who came on only once it became cool with the iPhone and the iPad. All of us were upset when he died, to some degree. And why was that if he was not a kind person? And so when you view the film in that light, there actually is an interesting narrative to see there. Has anybody else gotten the chance to see this film yet?
No, not yet, but it's on my to see list eventually.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either, but
yeah, Blake was here. I've not yet seen it. I've been looking forward to it, but
so Ken, what was your feeling on, like, had you seen it all before? Even apart from knowing all the facts before, did it? I mean, I know it's constructed and it's telling a story and that sort of thing that is unique to the film. But I'm wondering if there are, sort of like, apart from the interviews, the new interviews, were there any sort of like archival footage that you hadn't come across before?
I don't think I'd actually seen his deposition video before. This was, I think, in the late 2000s regarding one of the many antitrust issues, I guess, that Apple faced. And I don't think I'd seen that before, and that was vaguely interesting just to see how bored Steve Jobs was with all of it. Like, at one point they asked him, can you give us your work history, please? And he's like, well, I worked for Atari. And they're like, and when was that? And he's like, I don't know, early 70s, I guess? Which was interesting, because it was almost like Steve Jobs had not read Walter Isaacson's book, which he didn't because he was dead, but you get my point.
Right.
That you'd think that Steve Jobs would know his own story at least as well as we do. But So that was interesting. And as you said, the new footage was interesting. I liked the interviews with Chrisanne Brennan, who, even though she has her own book out on the subject, I think it's called A Bite of the Apple, which I have not read. I otherwise have never heard or seen anything from her directly. So I thought that was an interesting perspective that I was not previously familiar with. There were a lot of perspectives missing from the movie, though. For example, given how tight-lipped Apple is about everything, it's not surprising that there's no interview with Tim Cook or Johnny Ive, for example. But there's also nothing from Steve Wozniak or anybody else in Steve Jobs' family besides Chrisanne Brennan. So there's not even... They quote Lisa Jobs Brennan at one point, but they have a voice actor reading her lines from a blog post she wrote that you can find on the internet. So that wasn't exactly exclusive. At first, I thought it was her voice, like she had literally phoned in her performance, but it wasn't even that.
Well, I'll watch it no matter what.
Yeah, because that's what we do. Yep. And same reason why I'm going to go see the Michael Fassbender film. I don't think it's going to be very accurate, and I've already seen the Ashton Kutcher film, and I just saw this documentary, but how can I not go see it? I mean, it's Magneto as Steve Jobs. That's awesome.
Okay.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Well, on a totally different tangent, Paul, Retro Battle Stations Basic in week 5.
Yes, so...
Please tell me more.
Sure. So there's a... I have to say, I am not a particularly Reddit competent person. So I don't... But there is a subreddit called Retro Battle Stations, and it's actually... seems to be quite large. It says... in the little sidebar, it says, 12,000 readers. So I don't know what that means, but I guess there are a lot of people reading it. It just covers retro computing topics in general. But frequently there are sort of theme weeks. And so this is we're coming up. Actually, by the time this comes out, we will be kind of midway through basic week 5. So this is the 5th installment, and basically it's something, no pun intended, it's something like a contest where essentially what you're doing is you're taking a set program. So in the previous basic weeks, there have been, little graphic drawing programs or, certain target programs that you are to port to your retro computer and, sort of take a photo. No emulators are allowed in the photo of it. Operating, but there are ports. So this week it's a sort of like explore Winchester, the old mansion out on Winchester Drive. And so there's a program. It's up on GitHub. It has an Apple II and a Commodore 128 version. What's being explored this time around is it's supposed to be sprites, which actually seems like a little bit of a hazardous thing to try to do because, the Apple II didn't have sprites. The Apple II version here is using shape tables, which is something kind of similar and can be used in BASIC. And it does say actually that you don't have to use sprites. You can sort of mock it up with text characters or whatever the platform has. But it's something to be written in BASIC, and it's something like a contest. Although one thing that's generated a little bit of discussion on the mailing list is that it's a contest where the winner is drawn at random. So, but so you have to want to do this to participate. But it looks cool. I keep failing to remember to check in on Retro Battle Stations. The guy who runs it has a fairly active Twitter account, so I do follow that. So I hear about this anyway. I'll think about this. I suspect that I'm not going to have time to participate, but I like being able to kind of like watch it happen.
No, it's sort of like an ongoing hackfest, I suppose, an ongoing retro challenge. I think I'll have to start following this one just to see how people are going. I do love the fact that it's to be done on the real computers and that the screenshots have actually got to, apart from not being on an emulator, I've actually got to include the computer that it's running on. So it should be an interesting one to follow. Well, Another interesting thing to follow is over on Mike Willigal's website, he has a collection of links on the Selby 8008, and also as part of that, there's a link included in that for building your own reproduction Selby. Now, this is a very early computer that I haven't had much exposure to, apart from seeing the occasional piece of reference to it in a book on eBay or one of the other book aggregators or Amazon. But it's actually good to see that someone is building a reproduction of these early machines. And there's also a link to a emulator. It seems that it's an OS X one, so hopefully that can be ported to other platforms. And there's also a link to Mike's blog on his building the machine, the various cards, hooking it up to a laptop to play back WAV files in lieu of having a cassette player to play them back. So it's all in all a great starting point for finding out about the Selby mini computer and the Intel 8008. And there, as I said, there's lots of links in there for the machine itself, including a registry of where actual physical real machines are, and it's excellent blog on designing and building your exceedingly retro computer. So has anyone else seen this bit of Mike's work? I know we're very familiar with a lot of his other projects, but this one seemed to have slipped past me, and has only just recently popped up on my radar.
Well, I know that Mike Willigal has been working on this for quite a while. In fact, I've seen his sort of like posts of various bits of progress. He has actually a podcast feed, which I don't see an easy way to find here, but maybe we can find it for the show notes. But he's posted little videos of various stages of getting this thing ready over the past, I don't know what, a year or something, at least, probably more than that. But yeah, it's really quite something. The registry you mentioned has 13 list entries. There are 13 known Selby computers. So, and what sort of brought it up just recently is that he basically just got it done. So he's basically now created a working reproduction Selby, and I think you can actually get the or at least I think he's going to make it possible to get the kit from him.
Yeah, you click on the link for it, and it's basically build your own, as in these are the panels that you'll need to create, these are all the parts, and he has reproduction boards available. So looks like a very interesting project. Yeah, I've bookmarked this one to sort of like come back to when I can find some spare time, because this is quite a major undertaking to do all of this from scratch.
Definitely. Yeah, I've piled up a bunch of projects that are still not done. So, but the video I was remembering, there is, it's actually almost, it's sort of painful but fun still. One of the videos has him, I think it may be on the actual Selby that he was using, like toggling in. it's like 20 minutes of him like toggling stuff in, and then getting partway and having to start over. And but I mean, so if you really want to see what it's like, it's right there in full detail and full, like no sped up anything.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate keyboards in a whole new way.
But it's very cool. Yeah.
Okay, so Jack, newish old school graphics.
Yeah, so this is something that popped up lately in the past couple of weeks. Someone on YouTube who calls himself the iBook Guy has started publishing a couple, a small series of videos about how old school graphics worked on old computers and consoles. So far, there are just two parts to this, two sort of episodes in this little series. The first one is Commodore and Nintendo, specifically talking about the Commodore 64, and the second one is Apple and Atari. And here he's talking about the Apple II, and not the Atari 8-bit computer, but the Atari 2600, which is really kind of the predecessor, so there's some commonality. So basically, the part one, the Commodore and Nintendo, he's kind of comparing these two systems because they kind of they had a lot of similarities. They both worked with this sort of block-based graphics modes where within a certain block you had a certain number of pixels and you could use a certain number of colors within that block, which can then be switched from one block to the next. And then the second episode contrasts that with how the Apple II did things and how the Atari VCS did things. And he does a good job of sort of laying these things out and presenting them. He has like some nice graphic aids explaining how the things work, and I had a small complaint that in the second one he didn't quite get some, he kind of skimmed over some of the critical parts of the Atari stuff, so I had to go and leave a comment there because, you know, when someone's wrong on the internet, I mean, you just can't let that stand. So, anyway, apart from him not being 100% accurate at all times, pretty good series so far, and I'm looking forward to seeing more parts of it. I've certainly learned a lot about how the Commodore and Nintendo did stuff, because I never really quite got some of those details. And there are very interesting discussions in the comments in both of these, where a lot of people are sort of putting forth a lot of other detail and little bits of trivia about how these things work. So, pretty fun.
Cool. Yeah, I've definitely seen reference to these, but I haven't quite followed up on them. Maybe this is maybe your mention of it here is enough to push me over into actually watching them.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, it makes you appreciate the amount of effort that programmers have had to go into to get the graphics working on these older machines. From my own experience with the Apple II, getting shape tape, actually creating shape tables and then using them wasn't the easiest thing, and it did make me quite jealous of the systems that had built-in sprite functionality, and definitely a very interesting series to follow. But we shall move along to Daffy Duck.
Yeah,
Paul. What's Daffy Duck doing in this podcast?
This was sort of a weird thing. So I'm only coming in on this story at the end, you know. So I didn't the enormity of it is somewhat lost on me, I think. But apparently, way at the end of the Commodore's time, there was a game called Daffy Duck and the Great Paint Caper that was to be released by a company called Hi-Tech. So this is 1992, which sounds astoundingly late to me, but. And apparently it had been, like, reviewers had seen it had gotten written up, and, you know, it basically was almost ready to go, and then, like, various companies collapsed and got bought out and threw out all their stuff, and apparently this was basically designated as kind of a holy grail of lost Commodore games. So the link that we'll include here is to a place called Games That Weren't, GTW64, searching for the lost C64 games, and they say that they basically started life as a magazine article in Commodore Zone in 1997, and one of the very first titles they had in their list of things we want to try to find, you know, they knew it existed and no copies were out there, was this Daffy Duck thing. And so if you follow the link, there's a big long write-up of basically like the stuff that led to eventually finding somebody who had the game in a closet. So it was coded by Dave Saunders, graphics by Ashley Routledge, and sound by Gerard Gourley. I think it's Ashley Routledge who ultimately had this. And so it says, in August of 2015, Frank of the GTW set off to Ash's hometown in the Midlands to meet up for lunch and to collect Ash's discs in person. Anyway, the rest of the story is it was recovered. So that's pretty cool. I have not played it. I hadn't heard of it before the recovery story, but it's got to be extra neat for the people who have really been looking for this for 18 years or whatever it is to finally have it be there. It's sort of, I guess in a way, it's sort of like the, it has the Inigo Montoya problem at the end, though. It's like, all right, well, now what?
No, it's always great to find things like fight this. You know, you've got the Prince of Persia story, getting the source code. You know, there are lots of things that were sort of announced, sort of like vaporware in magazines, and you know that some of the stuff never actually was going to see the light of day. But to something like this, and to finally, after all this time, to get it and have the disc images available to download and play. That seems to be what we've got here, downloads. And I think it says in here that 6 to 8 floppy disks with the all the source code for it. Be interesting to see how many disc images it requires to actually get it started and to play. But no... I think this is something I'm going to... I've always been a bit of a Daffy Duck fan from the cartoon days, so I think I might take this one for a spin myself.
I think I will. I think I'll see if I can try it, at least, just out of respect for the project.
Mm. But, no, definitely a long process of tracking it down and then finally getting hold of the discs from the author has a box of discs and not really sure what's on them, and then going for a little bit of a digital dig. So earlier on we alluded to talking about Oscar. Now, Paul, you haven't got round to building your PyDP8 yet either, have you?
I have not. I have... opened it. It's beautiful.
It sits there and just calls out for, you know, I opened the box several times since it's arrived just to look it over, but I'm definitely going to have to put aside a good amount of time and set my desk up downstairs for that soldering project. But Oscar has sent us in a request for help. The PyDP8 has actually made Hackaday's 10 finalist list. So if you've bought or you just like the PyDP8, if you could go over to the Hackaday website and show your support for the project. So it's going to be reviewed by a panel of judges, and all that information is there on the Hackaday finalists web link that we'll include. But to show your support and then also to follow how things are going, there's a link to the PyDP8 project entry page. So go down there. You'll have to register for the site. And Oscar's basically hoping that if he does win one of the prizes, that he'll be able to use it to go towards some more PDP replica work. He's got some great plans there that hopefully will come through in the future. And it's actually great to see projects like this get recognized. And this Hackaday competition is no small competition. There's some quite considerable prizes up for grabs here. And the competition that the PyDP8 is up against, there are some great projects there. Not necessarily retro, like the PyDP8, but definitely shows the engineering creativity of people out there. But you know, I've gone in there and I'm following Oscar's entry, and I've given it my skull of approval. And looking forward to hearing about the results of the Hackaday competition, and hopefully we'll have some good news for other listeners who have bought or are just in awe of the PyDP8. So good luck, Oscar.
Yeah, I cannot wait to build that. I need to wait, but I cannot wait. So
As far as kits go, the quality of the parts that supplied and the custom bits and pieces for it, it's just phenomenal. Other bits and pieces there that Oscar has done, so it's definitely worth popping over to his website as well. So all these links in our show notes. Okay, Paul.
Yeah, so just one quick note. I was very surprised to see this, but and I don't know this magazine really, but it looks fairly serious. There's a magazine called Nuts and Volts, and in the September 2015 issue, the cover story is an article on adding color to your pet, to your Commodore pet, and apparently it looks like they're starting a like a vintage computing regular feature, and the first one is looking at the Commodore PET, which is of course, you know, this all-in-one unit that looks like the future, and but it's, you know, monochrome green, and the article kind of goes through. I saw this and I immediately, you know, just subscribed so that I could read the article. But it's kind of neat. It, you know, it goes through and talks about how the video circuitry works, and there's a description of making a board that will add in the color and. But anyway, I thought it was remarkable that it's coming out in a new magazine that is normally, you know, sort of like for electronics hobbyists and you know, Arduino programmers and the like. So that's it.
Okay. Well, I think we'll now pause for a word from one of our sponsors in the past.
Aren't you astronauts?
Buzz Aldrin.
Gordon Cooper.
Scott Carpenter.
We like to compare notes with Stevie on the new space station.
Hello?
Hi, Tommy Lasorda for Stevie.
Hey, what's up?
Just a question about moving Random to the number two position.
Yeah, second, and this will work. It's perfect.
Hi.
Hey.
We're the Pointer Sisters.
Stevie's expecting us.
Well, come in.
We need help with our new album.
The Amiga. Color, sound, graphics, power. At a price to make it truly the computer for the creative mind. What can the Amiga do? Well, what do you want it to do?
Mr. O'Neill, Stevie is upstairs, but it's kind of crowded. Would you like some fried chicken while you're waiting?
Amiga from Commodore. The computer for the creative mind.
Well, for our retro computing gift idea, I came across what I thought would be a good one for the retro gamers. Now, everybody has Tetris or a version of Tetris for their various machines, and if you haven't, you should. But for those times when you're not firing up your machines, here is a great little desk lamp over at our friends at ThinkGeek. And it is a stackable LED desk lamp in all your Tetris shapes, so you can reassemble it in whatever shape you like. And I think it's just an amazing product. So I'm thinking I'm adding this one to my Christmas gift list.
This thing looks very, very cool. I'm pretty amazed.
I have to say,
yep.
I in fact have one of these.
Oh.
Oh.
One thing that I noticed about these is that they do have to be situated quite carefully in order for the lights to all work, you know, because they have to make electrical contact between them. But it's a very cool idea.
Yeah, I was just trying to see if you can actually buy two sets and combine them.
I'm sure they will allow you.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sure they'll allow me to buy two, but I'm just wondering if it's designed to be extended that way. But I suppose you can always just work off multiple bases. But no, I just saw this and my inner geek just went real happy. Yeah, so this, as I said, this one's definitely going to go on my Christmas list. Folks are always looking for something for me, so I just go, oh, I don't know, just get me a book. But this might make a pleasant change from the book.
Right.
Okay, well, moving on to other things that are available to our favorite playground of eBay. So, Jack, an Atari 2600 clone.
Yes, so this is something that I've heard of now and then, but haven't really seen. This is a machine that is designed to look just like the classic Atari 2600, not a six switch, but a four switch. But it also contains, as proclaimed by two stickers on the case, 999 games built in. So it has a cartridge port, but it also has apparently just under 1,000 pirated games available for your gaming pleasure right out of the box.
They couldn't have found one more.
And right now it's... Yeah, exactly. It's so close. They were so close. I'm guessing actually they couldn't fit 1,000 on that sticker. Yeah. They had to, they wanted that font in that exact size. And I said, no, guys, we got to stop there. Because we don't want to be too big of a sticker. So, anyway, it's got a buy it now price of 35 British pounds. The seller says he will only sell within the EU. I don't know why the seller's in Slovakia, so I don't know why it's not showing the price in euro, but it's in pounds, but there it is. Anyway, it looks like it's decently clean and stuff. It's not terribly filthy or anything like that. It includes a joystick, which is not a regular Atari joystick, but something else. I mean, I don't know what it is. I'm sure it will work with Atari joysticks as well. And it has a little classic game TV switch box, all that stuff. So all the parts you need for playing with it. And the nice thing about this, of course, you don't actually have to get any cartridges. You just get this thing and you've got 990 games to play. So anyway, looks pretty cool.
But it looks like it accepts cartridges, right?
Yeah, it does. So it has the cartridge slots. You can put cartridges in it as well. But if you happen to want to play one of those 999 games, it's already right there.
So basically, when you run out of playing those 999 games, you can just keep on using it with your own extensive collection of cartridges.
That's right. And honestly, I'd guess that anyone who tires of those 999 games has tired of life.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't realize there were that many games for the 2600.
So. Were there that many Atari games?
There were. I think if you actually count all the kind of things that were sort of just reissues or, somebody made something and then someone else licensed it and released it again 2 years later or whatever, that you actually come up in the thousands. I've heard numbers anywhere between 2,000 and 4,000, but again, a lot of those are going to be kind of duplicates. And so I guess even in that 1,000, some of those games are probably going to be almost identical games to each other. But there were a whole lot of games, no question about it. I think that approximately 1,000 unique games is what I've heard.
Wikipedia says there are 565 games, but maybe for certain games like combat, for example, there are different modes where you can go from controlling planes to tanks, and maybe it counts each mode as a different game.
Well, that's possible. That could be.
I'm sorry, not combat, air sea battle, but probably both anyway.
Yeah, combat is the same sort of thing.
Okay, so Ken, what have you found for us from the wonderful world of Atari Soft?
Games! That's what I do. I love games. So I found a person on eBay who was selling a lot of, and he means that literally, not like a lot of three Atari Soft games, Moon Patrol, Galaxian, and Jungle Hunt. And you get all three new in box, so they say, for $23.49 with free shipping from Las Vegas, Nevada. And he or she is selling 10. Actually, no, it says more than 10 available. Two have been sold so far. Now, I've seen other Atari Soft lots being put on eBay. Some of them have been linked to from the Facebook group. And it seems like these games, I don't know. It's like this seems to be the same quantity as the ET cartridges that were put under dirt in Alamogordo, New Mexico, except these ended up on eBay instead. Like, they just skipped the whole dirt pile aspect and just went right onto eBay because there are so many of these games still new in box, and you can get them for fairly cheap. So I don't know what the story is behind that, if some distributor went out of business and just had a whole palette of Atari Soft games and said, here, take all you want, we have more. But this is not exactly a rare find that I have found on eBay. But since it's three games for an average of about less than $8 each, that's not a bad deal in my opinion, especially for new in box. If Carrington ever gets his podcast off the ground where he unboxes new games, that would be prime fodder for that show.
He could have a year's worth of episodes opening Galaxian, just one after the other every week. And this week's Galaxian. Yeah, so it must be the case that I'm pretty sure basically they just overproduced these massively at a time when they were not selling, because these are all over the place. So if you want to open a shrink wrapped 80s game, you know, this is the way to do it. I myself have way too many of these, and the problem is I can't get, you know, how am I going to get rid of them? I don't even know if they're actually particularly good games, but I think they basically just hit at the wrong time, or either that or Atari just like does not know where the decimal point is supposed to go. So
yeah, that's what I wondered about these things. Like, I remember, you know, I was not in the Apple II world at that time, but I was you know, doing Atari stuff when I was a kid, and I remember when Atari was making games for Apple, like this rang a bell. It's like, oh yeah, they you know, Atari Soft doing just the Apple II software. But like, were these games any good? The Apple II versions of these that they made, were they any good compared to anything else or compared to other Apple II games? Like, were they? I just have no idea.
No idea here either.
I think some of them were.
Yeah, I do recall having played all of those games, but they weren't really the kind of game I was interested in playing. But no, as Ken said, if you're after the new in box and rip the shrink wrap off, this is a good way of doing it. Fairly reasonable unit price for three.
There are a few that are slightly more rare than others, you know, so like these three are particularly, in fact, I'm almost certain that what happened here is that this seller, you know, took, so there was, months ago and 4 months, there was someone who was selling like 200, like a lot of like 250 of them or something like this. You know,
individual games and multiple hundred copies of each. And that was the lot you were purchasing. Yes, I remember those.
And I suspect that this is, you know, where that ended up. I believe actually, I don't know if this is pertinent, but I believe actually those were the leftovers from Sun Remarketing, which was the shop that also sold Lisa's and Apple IIIs kind of late into the, you know, like well after Apple ditched them.
Mm.
Anyway, whatever. So it's possible that, you know, there might be some history in the shrink wrap here somewhere.
Okay, so Paul, while you've got the mic,
yeah.
What have you found on eBay?
It's so hard to find anything. Okay, let's see. What have I found on eBay? I found a bunch of things. I probably won't talk about all of them, but so one of them that seemed sort of interesting was an Interact Model 1. It says Interact Model 1 Vintage Video Game Computer with Original Box, Manuals, and Games. And it shows a box. It's the Interact Home Computer System, it says on the box. And then on the device itself, it says Interact Computacolor. And on the manual, it says Interact Family Computer. So I don't know what this thing is called. But this, apparently, this is, I think, legitimately quite rare thing. It was sold in very small numbers, and I think it was I looked this up and then didn't bring it up again, but I think it's, you know, something like it's in that same like 1977 type era, 1978 apparently, or at least the 1978 Microsoft Level 2 Basic Language Manual is included. But so this is a really kind of an interesting thing. I think that there were not many sold, so there's probably not much of a community around it, but I think it would be interesting to play with it. And this is what's cool about this is it has all the stuff. You know, there's the box, there's the manuals, there's actually what appears to be quite a extensive cassette collection with it. And I should just to describe it, it's actually it looks like it has a kind of like a, I'm not sure, maybe it's something like a chiclet or gum keyboard or whatever. And then built into it is a cassette player off to the right. So it looks like, I think there were some Amstrads that looked like this. Anyway, so it's a cool thing. Right now it's priced as a cool thing. So the opening bid is $300 and the buy it now price is $390. It's worth looking at anyway. Then, so I had a big list of things, but I will just very quickly breeze over the easy ones. There's an IBM Portable 5155 that someone started at $9.99. It's working. It comes with a copy of IBM DOS 2.1. They show it working. It looks nice. It's missing the sliding back panel that sort of covers part of the back of it, but I think they all are. So and it doesn't keep it from working. So if you were looking for one of these, this will quite possibly tell you, you know, exactly how little they can go for, because it is it's being started at very low. Another thing I found that seems like it might be interesting, I don't know, is a Star Raider cartridge for the Atari 400-800. It is for the game Star Raiders, but it is apparently one of the early ones where they forgot to pluralize the label, so it says Star Raider. And apparently this is legitimately a thing. The early ones had this typo. So this is one of the early ones. If you want to buy it now for $30 plus shipping, you can do that. Jack, is this something that seems desirable? I don't really have any sense of like...
I've seen some of those around. Like, I don't know how rare that label is compared to anything else, compared to the ones that actually has an S. I don't think the game itself is any different. It's just the label. And I don't know. I don't think it's super, super rare. But, you know, maybe for the completist, it could be something to have. So, and actually, my impression is that I know that Atari sold... they sold some sort of game package for the Atari 400 and 800. I think they called it, like, the gamer. Like, you bought a box that had a couple of joysticks and a couple of games, and I think Star Raiders was in there. And I think this may have been one of the pack-in games for that they had the game labeled as Star Raider instead of Star Raiders. That may be the truth, but I may be way off.
So, anyway, it seems mildly interesting, at least. And I guess maybe the last thing I'll mention in this... Oh, well, there's I guess one of the ones I found was a lot of 8 vintage computer fans. I thought, hey, you know, we're 4 vintage computer fans. We could triple our number. And the last one I'll mention is it's a Commodore CBM Model 8050 dual drive floppy disk for PETs. So it's a, you know, sort of PET styled, it's a CBM PET styled floppy drive. And it's monstrous. I mean, these things, all of these things are huge, but so it looks very cool. It's buy it now for $80 actually, though. So I bet, in fact, that's not going to last very long. I'll try to edit quick.
No, that's quite an interesting one, that one. Okay, well, speaking of my desire of books, I came across this one, The Giant Handbook of Computer Projects, from the editors of 73 magazine. So this is from 1979, and there's a whole pile of microcomputer projects, Altair 8800, there's Kim 1, and what caught my interest is also some information there on the Selby as well. So hardcover book. Yeah, reasonable price, $24.99. Says it's got expedited shipping, international shipping of $24 for me, so that's actually quite reasonable for shipping a hardcover book. They can actually be quite weighty, and all the way from Pennsylvania. So, if you're after a book of computer projects and you like the old-style books, this might be something that will pique your interest. Now, Jack, I apologize. I didn't see this entry of yours, and it looks very interesting. Do you want to tell us more about this PDP-8?
Yeah, well, this is a late-breaking entry that I threw in here while we were talking. So anyone who gets their interest whetted by the PDP-8 might like this item. There's someone selling an actual PDP-8E. It's an enormous thing. It's a mainframe with 32K of memory. It's in Englewood, Colorado, which is important because if you're not nearby and can pick it up, you're going to have it freight shipped to you in some way that will cost a fortune. The asking price, the buy it now price, you could get this today for $5,500. So it's a little towards the high end of what most of our listeners might be interested in spending, but it's a very cool thing. And having had access to one of these in college to play with and enter programs in with, you know, the method we discussed earlier of flipping these switches, these toggles up and down, and hitting buttons and stuff. It is a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of fun. But again, you can also do this using the Pi DP8 a little more simply and easily and cheaply. But if you feel like that's not enough, you need the real thing, it is out there. And I think they're claiming that this thing works and stuff, I guess. So, and whoever is selling this says that they also have some sort of cartridge drive that was part of the system that could also be of interest if anyone wants that. That I have no idea what that is. But anyway, there it is. And there are nice pictures of the thing. It's missing some switches, that things are a little kind of half broken on the front panel. But it's enough that it works, but it doesn't look that nice. And there's some pictures showing the internals and stuff. Pretty cool.
Mm.
Yeah, that is quite nice. It says, pulled from a working Genrad model 1792, operational at the time of deinstall. Unit too old for a return.
In other words, you buy it, keep it. Oh, yeah, I'd love to have that, but a little bit pricey for me, and I don't even want to guess at how much it would cost for shipping.
And I forgot one that I did mean to I should have mentioned and failed to. Can I stick that in here?
You certainly can.
Okay, so this is because it seems really pretty cool. It is a antique vintage computer word processor, CPT-8100. So I didn't know anything about this before I saw the auction and kind of went and looked around, but it actually does seem to be a pretty functional computer. It has, it's big. It looks like a terminal, but it's a full computer. It has, I think, 8-inch drives.
Those definitely 8-inch drives.
But and it looks like it's got quite a bit of stuff with it. It's got some discs. It's got the manuals. So I don't know actually how the shipping works. if you happen to be in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, then you can go pick it up. But otherwise, I think you'll have to deal with the fact that this is going to be a heavy thing to ship. But its starting bid is $41, which is nothing. Oh, and the other thing too, when I saw pictures of this, it had in the pictures a really cool looking kind of like racing stripe on the side. And none of these photos actually show the angle that has that really cool racing stripe, but I think it's on there. So I think this is going to be a really cool looking computer in someone's collection. Somebody get this, because I don't want to have to try to work out how to ship it.
I think it's funny that in the description it says, I don't know whether this works or not. I haven't found the power cord yet, but the plugs look like a standard PC. It's like totally standard. They have a picture of it. It's totally standard PC power cord in the back. And they're like, no, I don't know. I can't plug this thing in.
You'd almost pull it out of a toaster. Yeah. So ubiquitous, that cable.
Oh, well. Pretty cool. I've never seen anything like this.
Okay, well, let's start wrapping this up. So, Jack, you've got some happy news for us.
Yes, I just want to mention that today, as we are recording this on September 13th, it is Jason Scott's birthday. Happy birthday to everyone's favorite digital archivist. I think I know how old Jason Scott is actually turning today, but I'm not going to say because a gentleman never tells.
Should we sing happy birthday?
No.
No.
Not, we don't have the licensing fee money.
There'd be a little bit of a sync problem.
Yes, he might never talk to us again. So, Paul, what's happening in your office?
Well, I've actually made a fair amount of progress. As Ken alluded to before, the academic year has started. You know, all the classes have to be planned and executed, and homework has to be graded and so forth. And I have this feeling that I would be more productive if my office were tidy. So, I have been spending a fair amount of my time.
Sorry, let me Google that term. I'm not familiar with it. It's tidy. Mm.
Tidy. Mm. But, antonym, Paul's office. But, so...
See Michael's office. Right.
So, but I've been kind of going through and essentially just kind of like, pushing things up, making things perpendicular, pushing things off to the side, and actually moving things to a different room and setting up a bunch of my machines just so that they're actually, if I'm going to be going through them anyway, I might as well make sure they work and stuff. And I've done some kind of creative, again recalling the Tetris of before, I've done some creative vertical stacking and so forth, but...
I was going to say, perhaps you need to concentrate on purchases that are stackable.
Yes. And I have kind of a neat stack here. It's got a PowerMac G3 on it, LC475. These are a Mac. That inside that is a Apple IIe card, and then on top of that is a Duo dock that holds a Duo. 2GS on top of that, and then the monitor for the lower machines on top of the 2GS. It's a very tall, crazy looking thing, but and they all work, and most of them run off compact flash cards. So that's pretty cool. And I'm still kind of making my way through, but it's quite a bit of fun. I got my next slab working, although I couldn't quite get it on the net, but that's the next step. And I've unburied my Apple III, and so anyway, it's a lot of fun. I really should be working on other things.
There's nothing like reorganizing moving around retro stuff to use up all that spare time that you've got, and all that other not spare time that you've got. Okay, well, nothing much happening at the moment in my end of the world, apart from all my bits and pieces that I've ordered for my top secret project has arrived. So hopefully in a couple of episodes time, I'll be able to let our listeners in on what I'm creating. I'm sort of going down a tangent of my expertise in my day job is printer data streams, so that's a little bit of a hint of what I'm doing. So it's definitely retro computer based, and I'm not going to say for what platform, but I think you might be surprised as to what platform this will actually work on. So, any other happenings out there, Ken? You doing anything interesting, or is it everything just so interesting it's just all become so blasé?
No, this has been a very retro computing filled lazy Sunday, so to speak. I spent the morning editing the next issue of Juice GS, got another 8 pages in. Looks like it's going to be the biggest issue of Juice GS ever, so I recommend everybody go renew their subscription. Thank you.
Excellent.
I think I already have, so I look forward to seeing that arrive in my letterbox.
Me too.
Okay, folks, well, that's it for this show. You can find our notes for this show and all our shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vintagecomputer.com in the Vintage Computer Forum. You can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And, of course, we love to receive your feedback. So quickly grab that keyboard and send us off an email about what you do with user groups or anything else that you think that the retro computing community would find interesting. So send that to feedback at rcrpodcast.com. We also are a member of the Throwback Network. So pop on over and see what other retro-inspired podcasts there and have a listen. And please, if you do have the time, pop on over to iTunes and rate the show and give us a review. That will help other people find us when they're just browsing for podcasts that are out there. So everybody, until next time,
Retro Compute!